You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge with host Joanne Hardesty. Today's guests are John Nichols and Robert W. McChesney, authors of the new book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America.
Hello, I'm Celeste Carey.
And I'm Cecil Prescott.
As we approach the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John Kennedy, we reflect on the eventful year of 1963.
In our next More Talk radio program on November 18th, our guest will be Byron Williams, an acclaimed columnist for the Huffington Post.
We'll discuss his provocative book, 1963, The Year of Hope and Hostility. And we'll look at the Kennedy administration, the civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and George Wallace.
That's Monday, November 18th at 8 a.m. on More Talk Radio, right here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to join the Native American Appreciation Club and Mecha Club in co-sponsoring the First University of Portland Powwow, Saturday, November 16th at 1 p.m. Everyone is welcome to come celebrate and honor Native American Heritage Month. There will be traditional Native and Aztec dancers, singers, drummers, vendors, and more. That's the First University of Portland Powwow to take place at the Child Center, 5000 Willamette Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found on the right-hand side of KBOO.FM under Community Events.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University, with 5 part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment, the very hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. December 5th evening information session, details at merrillhurst.edu.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am so thrilled to have in the studio today two fascinating thinkers about our democracy. I have John Nichols and I have Robert W. McChesney. And I want to tell you a little bit about both of them, but since we have a late start, I'm going to do a very minimum introduction. And so I want you to know that John Nichols is the National Magazine Washington, D.C. correspondent. He's a pioneer political blogger. He's written the magazine's best column since 1988. Nichols is also a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times. He is also the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to the studio, John.
Thank you, Joanne.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you to have you here. And Robert W. McChesney is the Gassell Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana
Champagne.
Champagne. Just like the drink. I spelled that wrong. And the author of or editor of 23 books. His work has been translated into 30 languages. He is co-founder of Free Press, a national media reform organization. Welcome you to the program, Robert.
It's my pleasure to be here. You can call me Bob.
Very cool. Bob. Okay, we're informal here.
That's right.
Well, wonderful. Well, I want to jump right in because I think the book that you've just written, Dollarocracy, How the Money in Media Election Complex is Destroying America, is one of the must-read books of our time, especially before we get into 2014, which is another election nightmare that's coming. So, John, you want to start?
Sure.
Why did you gentlemen collaborate on this book?
Well, we've been collaborating for a long time.
Okay.
For about the better part of 15 years, we've been writing books together.
Oh.
And historically, we wrote books about media, the crisis of media. And they were books, frankly, that are rooted in precisely what you're working with here. We are on the side of small community radio stations, of public media, of media that's connected to our communities. And 15 years ago, what we talked about a lot was the crisis of a consolidating media. The big guys were getting bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. Over time, we wrote more and more about the collapse of old media. Even newspapers like the Oregonian laying off huge numbers of employees, radio stations, commercial radio stations, consolidating, getting rid of local shows. This kind of almost an end times mm-hmm. for traditional journalism and digital media, which we use all the time, not beginning to fill that void. So we started to ask the question, where does the information come from? Mm-hmm. And that's what evolved us toward this book, which is our biggest, it's by far our biggest project. We spent the better part of 3 years working on it. This book kind of takes it full circle and says, okay, as our journalism goes away, as it collapses, mm-hmm. as we have fewer and fewer ways to get solid, reliable information, what fills the void? And unfortunately, what we've determined is that since the Citizens United ruling in the Supreme Court, which unleashed all this corporate money, and that's part of many, many rulings along the way, we've ended up in a situation where the void is filled with campaign ads, mm-hmm. with political propaganda. And so what we're saying to people is, look, you need to wake up. I know most of your listeners already know this, right. But not everybody does. That in a democracy, the vote matters most. Mm-hmm. In a dollarocracy, the people who can buy those commercials, who can flood us with their information, mm-hmm. they are taking over. And the dollar begins to matter more than our votes.
Right.
Hence our title, Dollarocracy.
Wonderful. And so, Bob, I want to ask you, based on that, I don't know of anyone who enjoys those political campaign ads, right? I don't know of anyone who actually believes anything that they see in those campaign ads. So why are they so prevalent? And I know the answer to this, but I don't know if our listeners know the answer to this. So why are they so prevalent during campaign season?
Well, for starters, the amount of money there, that's what it goes to pay for. So in this last election, John and I calculated it, because we're the only democracy that doesn't actually keep track of how much money is spent on campaigns.
Right.
There's no record of it. And much of the money increasingly is what's called dark money. It's going through this labyrinth of sort of money laundering techniques, so you don't know who's paying for these ads oftentimes. Or if you're notified of it, it's well after the election in the fine print of an SEC filing, so you might see the name there, but it takes a lot of research and it's too late to have any effect on an election. And what we determined is there's almost $11 billion spent on the 2012 election, almost $11 billion, double what was spent in 2008, 10 times what was spent just 20 years earlier, even allowing for inflation. So it's an enormous amount of money, and most of that money, majority of it, goes to pay for television ads.
Right.
Your question answered it to some extent, everyone agrees. These ads are horrible, they're degrading, they're half-truths at best, they're decontextualized, they're sewage. And what's interesting is most Americans are so marinated in these ads because that's all we have for political information now. That's the definition of how you communicate politically.
Right.
We don't have journalism anymore. We don't have any other way of engaging politically during races, that we've lost sight of the fact of how weird these ads are. We've lost the ability to stand back and say, what on earth are we doing here?
Right.
Germany just had a national election. Germany had a 72% voter turnout, something if we had that in America, they'd call a national holiday to celebrate. Norway had an election right before Germany. They had 79% voter turnout. Britain had an election a few years ago, national election, so did Canada. None of those countries even allow political advertising. Mm-hmm. Political TV advertising in those countries is considered the equivalent of what chemical or germ warfare is to military encounters by the Geneva Convention. They're considered way out of bounds, that they pollute and destroy political discourse. They depress the vote because they make everyone turned off and cynical to elections, and they do nothing of value. And what you learn is, why did they work so well? And one of the interesting things about negative ads is they don't use those for commercial products. You know, you don't see Coca-Cola run a $10 billion campaign or a $100 million campaign talking about how horrible Pepsi is.
Right.
Don't drink Pepsi. Whatever you do, it's the worst drink ever made.
Right.
Because Coca-Cola only benefits people buy Coca-Cola, not if they don't buy Pepsi. They've got to convince them to buy their own product. Well, in politics, it doesn't work that way, especially in a two-party system. If you can convince people not to vote for your opponent, that's just as good as getting someone to vote for you. Because the whole thing is just getting one more vote than your opponent.
That's right.
So this race, really, is just as easy to turn someone off to your opponent as to get someone turned on to you. So this is why 90% of all the advertising is negative. And one last point on this. It does work. That's why they do it. The research shows it works. And it works for two reasons. One, in a political race, unlike a commercial marketplace, it's all or nothing. You need to get 50.01% of the vote. So you only have to change 100 votes, and that's everything. You win everything. All your chips are in one number.
Right.
And another thing is, with the absence of journalism, what we find is that even people who say, I hate those negative ads, I never watch them, I think whoever does them is awful, they actually do work because you have no other information. And we do focus group research with people after elections, and they say, why didn't you vote for that person? And invariably, they recite the negative ads verbatim. They do work.
Wow. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. You could also see John Nichols and Robert McChesney at Portland State University today at 12 noon. It's free, open to the public. They'll be at Smith Center, room 294. In addition, this evening, they will be in Eugene at the Knight Law Center starting at 7 p.m., and that's at the University of Oregon, Eugene. And all that information will be placed on the website and Facebook page later this morning. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. It's interesting that I want to pick up on the point where what we're really trying to do, and at least and from my perception, in these ads are move not a lot of people, right? So we're not talking about, we're not trying to change, you know, 10 million people's mind.
We sort of are.
Okay.
I love where you're going.
All
because
right.
Because on the surface level, Bob just said, if you move 100 one way or the other.
Right.
And Bob's absolutely right, that minimal number, we talk, before a national election in America, all we talk about is the swing voters.
Exactly.
And you understand what the swing voters are? These are people who after 200 and some years of American history, after all of the recent developments, after a whole campaign, still can't decide what to do.
That's right.
Right? I mean, maybe not the people you want to have guide you out of the wilderness.
That's
right.
That's right.
But no. The big numbers that are moved aren't those swing voters.
Mm.
And our media does such a rotten job of covering politics, they don't acknowledge. The big numbers that are moved are the people who don't vote.
The ones that stay home, yes.
Understand this. And we have such a horrible circumstance in this country where we have top pundits and political folks who will say, oh, well, you know, we've got lazy citizens. We've got lousy people in this country. That we hate our neighbors, right, or something like that. No. We have a media and money election complex in this country, which is primarily about making a lot of voters stand down.
Mm-hmm.
And understand the power of this.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, as Bob just pointed out, they had 72% turnout.
Right.
They have a media and a political system designed to get people to vote.
Yes.
They even try to maximize the vote from prisoners in Germany.
Wow.
In the United States, we have a system where the political consultants know that the best election for them is if it's a low turnout election and the people they have very well organized and managed turn out.
Right.
Yeah, just their folks. And so what do negative ads do? What does this $10 billion do? Primarily, it tells you, and I know, we know we were talking before air, you're deeply concerned about the prison industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
You are deeply concerned about mass incarceration, the new Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at an election.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know you vote every election, but I know, let's say you're looking at an election. You got a Democrat and a Republican running.
Right.
Democrat seems a little bit better on some of your issues, so you're probably going to vote for him. The Republican seems a little bit worse. Then you see an ad on TV tells you, oh, the Democrat, on some other issue, mm-hmm. choice, let's say, right. horrible person, worst person in the world. Or it won't even be on that. It'll actually say he walked down the street one time and he jaywalked. And
right. yeah.
But you see so much of this, you think, I'm sorry, I was going to vote for that guy, but I'm just sick of them all.
Mm-hmm.
And the sick of them all concept is the dominant reality of our politics today.
Mm-hmm.
In our presidential election last year, the most important election I think a lot of people have seen in a long time, 47% of the voting age population of America didn't vote.
Right.
In the 2010 election that gave power to the Republicans, put Republicans in charge of the House of Representatives, effectively ended Barack Obama's ability to govern mm-hmm. in a whole, you know, right. or put him in this tough situation. 63% of the voting age population in this country didn't vote. So who are these people that don't vote? Overwhelmingly, they're the busy, hardworking people who don't make as much money. They can't sit around and troll the internet or whatever. They're rushing out to do their job,
mm-hmm.
and all they're getting is this battering from ads mm-hmm. saying, yeah, stand down. Mm-hmm. It's all bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the end result is this warps our politics dramatically, and the money and media election complex that we have developed with so little good information coming in, so much bad and negative information coming in, creates a politics in America
mm-hmm.
where on some local elections, as many as 80-85% of people don't participate.
Mm-hmm.
So we have folks running multi-billion-dollar county governments, multi-billion-dollar city governments with a mandate from 7 or 8% of the population.
Yes, that's what we have. And then you put that on top of, depending upon whether you are poor or not, the quality of the voting machines you get when you show up and how long you have to wait to participate. We have a caller on the line.
Sure.
Hello, Miriam. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Hi.
I am glad someone is finally saying this. I have been trying to say this myself for years.
They say it so much better than we do, don't they?
Maybe not as well as Marion.
Yeah, really.
No, people talk about campaign finance reform. We need campaign reform.
Mm.
That is the real problem here. And the other problem, I think, I mean, you say people are very busy, and that's true. But, you know, it's not that difficult to find out some good information. There's a program called Project Vote Smart. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
Sure. Yeah, we are.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be that difficult for people to look at that. I don't know if it goes down to the county or city level. It may just go down to the state level, mm-hmm. but very good information.
I know it's at the state level, but it's interesting that you bring up that project because I remember as a former legislator, we were discouraged from filling out that questionnaire.
Yeah, by your caucus.
By our caucus.
Didn't want you to have any
right.
record that
yes.
could get at you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. But, yeah, I've heard that campaign managers.
But what Marion brings up is she just said something really important. She says, it's not that hard for people to get good information.
Mm.
She's right. But unfortunately, and we talk about this in the book, it's not just the current moment. We've created a whole structure, even with our education system,
mm-hmm.
which trains people to be employees but not to be citizens.
That's right.
And that's right. So many other aspects of things that we don't really steer people into citizenship.
No.
And so what they get as their prods, as their encouragements on voting, it's these negative ads. I mean, this is in so many races. We found races across the country. We talk about Illinois, mm-hmm. the race for lieutenant governor there in 2010. Some pawnbroker got in the race. He had millions of dollars.
Right.
He put on millions of dollars of ads. He beat state legislators and local officials who were running in the Democratic primary.
Right.
He became the Democratic nominee based on his ads.
Right.
And then afterward, it came out, after he's a Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. If you know anything about Illinois,
right.
lieutenant
right.
governors become governors because
yes.
governors go to jail.
That's right.
And so this is the interesting thing. After he gets nominated, he's the second most powerful guy in the party there and all that, comes out, well, his business is in trouble, may have something to do with his drug challenges,
mm.
or perhaps the domestic abuse issues that arose. The list was unbelievable.
Wow.
And like there was just all this outcry about him. And the interesting thing is sort of like a little sort of down at the bottom of the page, the Chicago Tribune's Chicago Sun-Times said, well, maybe we should have covered that race.
You know, I'd also add to that in the book what we try to talk about, this isn't a recent phenomenon.
Right.
It's not
right.
just Citizens United that right. triggered this. As Larry Lessig, the law professor, said, Citizens United put a bullet in the body of the politics, but the body was cold.
Uh-huh.
This is a long-term process. And what we do in the book is trace it really back. You know, to the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, between 1900 and 1970, there were a number of fantastic victories for democracy in the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, we often talk about the United States history like a series of defeats, the bad guys, mm-hmm. the powerful, the wealthy interests always dominating. But that's not true. We've won a lot of victories. We won the right to have unions. We won Social Security. We won unemployment insurance. We won Medicare. We won expanding public education to working class people and higher education to working class people like no other country in the world by the middle of the 20th century. And most importantly, we expanded the franchise. Mm-hmm. We went from a country in 1900 where only white men could vote, mm-hmm. for the most part, right. to by the early 1970s, all adults, everyone over 18 could vote. We became a genuine electoral democracy. And it's in that context, if we understand those battles and those fights, that we see what's dollarocracy emerge. Because right after we had universal adult suffrage in the early 1970s, the business community, led by the Chamber of Commerce and a gentleman named Lewis Powell, who wrote a very famous memo, confidential memo for corporate CEOs in 1971, really said, we've got to take over the government again. We have got to devote 10 times the amount of money we're spending in corporate lobbying to make sure whoever wins an election, business runs the country. We've got the crisis in America, they wrote, is there's too much democracy.
Well, the interesting thing is it really doesn't matter as far as how much money is spent, whether it's supporting Democratic candidates or Republican candidates, because what you find is that those big moneyed interests put money in both candidates. Because they really don't care. They could care less as long as they control the government after the election.
And that was the whole idea behind this movement of dollarocracy, which is basically to control the board no matter who wins. And getting to the point John was just making and the caller was getting at too, you know, but they understood the problem in America was that the system didn't work well if poor people, African Americans, women got involved in politics. It really, and so they basically want to make people cynical. They want to make people turned off to politics. That's the goal. If you're feeling cynical and depressed, that's how they want you to feel.
It's great for
them. They're scared to death when people say, no, I'm going to get involved. Right. I'm going to get engaged. That's the last thing. If they win that battle, they get you on the couch watching TV and say, I'm cynical, I'm depressed, I won't do anything, then they don't have to spend as much money to win the fight. And that was really the great battle. It grows right out of that. And dollarocracy with the elections is not just about elections. It's about governing. It's about controlling the budget, controlling the tax code, controlling the country, having the power. And after Powell's memo in 1971, there was a 10-time increase in corporate lobbying in Washington. Hmm. The term K Street came into existence. You know, it used to be Washington, D.C. in 1970. It was a sleepy middle-class town. It had no great industry.
Right.
But if you go to Washington, D.C. today, 4 of the 10 richest counties in America are the ring around Washington, D.C., and it's all that corporate money that's flooded the city, that's taken over the government. And taking over the elections is just part and parcel of taking over the government.
Let me offer you just if I can. Okay. Let's say the number again so people could call if they want.
Well, actually, we have two callers holding.
I'll throw you one notion off it before we do it. If we could give your listeners two words to frame this all out of. One is transactional, mm-hmm. and one is transformational. Mm. Poor people, working people, folks who are on the margins economically, trying to get a little bit better break in the society, maybe get ahead, get their kids go to school, have a little bit of security in their life. In the current situation with growing economic inequality, with all the challenges we have, they want a transformational politics.
Right.
When they vote to transform. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. The wealthy people, the people who guide so much of our country at this point, they want a transactional politics where they put their money down and they get something directly in return for it. No regulation, no taxes, structural things that benefit them.
Right.
So what we're really talking about here is whether our politics is transactional, mm-hmm. guided by the dollar, guided by the money, or transformational, guided by the vote.
Right.
That's the great clash. It's not Democrat or Republican. Mm-hmm. It's not independent. It's not green. It's not liberal, conservative, none of that. It's really about what the purpose of it is.
Right.
And to bring it full circle, we're just talking about Germany. In Germany, they have this very, very high turnout. The conservatives, the headlines say conservatives win control of the German government. You know what the conservatives do in Germany?
What?
Conservatives, right, in a non-moneyed system.
Right.
National health care, universal daycare, free public education, free university education, broadband build out for everybody. You go to the poorest neighborhoods in Germany and they've got good transportation, a pretty good structure. Because when you have a transformational politics, even conservatives accept that they have to do certain stuff because everybody's in.
Right.
When you have a transactional politics, you suddenly end up with a gated community, wealthy people getting what they want, the rest of us not.
Wow. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, hello.
Good morning.
I live in public housing, and I've been working around my apartment, so I haven't listened to every word you said. But here's what I've been sensing for some time. I've been sensing that our government and Congress and that have been taken over by a coup or think tanks or something. And I don't know, maybe I'm ignorant about this, but if you think so, could you say so in polite words?
Thanks, Joanne.
You know, Joanne, it's great because what you sense is absolutely accurate. Mm-hmm. And it's just not a coincidence, I think, that this is what scholars have come to explain to us. In fact, in the last year, Princeton University Press has published two major books by the leading political scientists in America, mm-hmm. from Berkeley, from Yale, from our top universities, who've done quantitative analysis of all the government decisions made in Washington in recent years. Right. And each book independently reached the same conclusion, that the values, concerns, interest of the bottom 95% of the American population have absolutely no effect on what the government does. Right. Government decisions are made uniformly on decision after decision by what wealthy, powerful interests want. They are really the only players in the room that matter when any serious decision on budget, taxation is being made. And then we were at our book release party in Washington 2 months ago. In the foreword of the book, we were very fortunate to have Bernie Sanders,
right?
U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, and he introduced us. He spoke at the
book
release.
You were not available, so we had to go. Yeah,
so he was at our book release event, and in his talk, he said, you know, he's been in the U.S. Senate now 7 years. Before mm-hmm. that, he served 16 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. And Senator Sanders said, I can tell you unequivocally, without condition, that it is impossible to get anything passed in the U.S. Congress that is opposed by Wall Street or large corporations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought that was from his experience.
Right.
I mean, to say unconditionally,
right.
That pretty much said what she understood. And you don't have to be a senator. You don't have to be a Princeton professor to understand what Joe Anderson says. You see the effects of dollarocracy around you. You see it in a pile of garbage on your street corner in a crummy public school. Right. You see it in a hungry kid or a homeless person. That's dollarocracy in action. You see it around you every day in this country.
Joanne was talking herself down a little bit. She was saying, we'll put it into polite terms.
Right, be
like
nice,
that.
Right, right.
You know, with all due respect, she said it exactly right. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's interesting. Have we been taken over by a coup or a think tank?
Mm-hmm.
What a brilliant combination she made there.
Yeah, yes.
Because,
yeah,
of course, the fact of the matter is that too often we think of a coup, mm-hmm. you know, as the army rolling in and, you know, taking over the radio stations.
That's right.
But the truth of the matter is that there are many ways to take over the politics of a country. Mm-hmm. One way is to dominate the generation of ideas,
mm-hmm.
and to say that the only ideas that can be in play are a narrow range of
That's
notions.
Right.
At The Nation magazine, we've done exposés in recent years on the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC,
mm-hmm.
and on the Fix the Debt campaign, the people mm-hmm. who say we've got to, you
right.
know, cut down Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid.
That's right.
What we find is that all these operations, Fix the Debt, these are billionaires,
yes.
literally spending hundreds of millions of dollars to say that the only logical answer to our problems is to not tax billionaires.
That's right.
But to start screwing with Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
That's right.
Well, what are they talking about in Washington?
Right.
Not taxing billionaires.
No.
Screwing with Social Security, Medicare, and
right.
Medicaid. So effectively what Joanne's talking about there is this thing of the think tanks, the mm-hmm. the broader buying of our discourse. And so even people who know in their heart and in their mind, they know what the better solution is.
Right.
They still think that's not an option.
Right.
The only option is what some very wealthy person decided to make an option.
Absolutely true. And so I'm going to, before the end of the program, we got to go, so now what? I know that there are some.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of hours.
Because you're depressing me at the moment.
No. We're almost at the half hour mark. That's where we flip to the positive.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So there is hope. I want to remind people that today at noon at Portland State University at Smith Center, room 294, these fabulous gentlemen will be there talking about dollarocracy. John Nichols and Robert McChesney will be there. And this evening at 7 p.m., they will be in Eugene at the Knight Law Center. At the University of Oregon. So you'll have ample opportunity in the next 24 hours to have this conversation and hear about the research these gentlemen have done. We have several callers on the line. Hello, Jane. Welcome to KBOO. Hello? James, are you there? I think we may have lost James, so we'll just jump back in the conversation. Okay, so we've acknowledged that Joanne knew what she was talking
she kinda
about.
She kind of nailed it, yeah.
She kind of nailed it. And I think most regular people get it, right? Most regular people say, You know, even when they participate in our democracy, even when they vote, mm-hmm. they stand in the long lines, they try to educate themselves and be knowledgeable about the issues. They say, well, what happened? Even if my candidate won, I'm still being screwed. Well,
let me go for that for a second. But this is the coolest thing of all. If you're really going, because I don't think you're depressed enough. Let's take you all in, okay? Let's go all in. In 2012, we had an election in this country. It was, you know, everything was pretty clear, I think. In case anybody was missing the point, Mitt Romney said, I don't care about 47% of the people. Mm-hmm. Right? That's pretty solid. That's a good, clear message there. Mm-hmm. And then just to get total clarity, he put Paul Ryan on his ticket, the guy who's been trying to go after Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, you know, the guy who led the final debate against Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, all that.
Right.
So you got absolute clarity.
Right.
People go out and they have that election. Nobody's got a mystery on what this is about.
That's right.
Heck, we call the thing that they're all against Obamacare, right?
That's
it's all very, very clear.
Right.
It's a big election.
Right.
Barack Obama wins by 5 million votes.
Right.
He wins every battleground state except North Carolina, almost wins North Carolina, wins a more than 100-vote margin in the Electoral College, a landslide.
Right.
He gets over 51% of the vote. That means he's got a higher percentage of the vote than John Kennedy in 1960, Richard Nixon in 68, Jimmy Carter in 76, Ronald Reagan in 1980, then Clinton in either of his elections, then Bush in either of his elections, including the one he lost.
Right.
And so you got this incredible mandate. Then in the Senate, Democrats are supposed to lose seats. They pick up a couple seats.
Right.
House of Representatives, only because of gerrymandering, don't Democrats take it, because more than a million people more vote Democratic than Republican. So it's a clear result.
Right.
1 year later.
Right.
What's going on?
Right.
We're tearing apart. Oh, Obamacare, we can't implement that. Right. You know, instead of saying, no, there's some problems with it, let's all get together and fix it, because clearly the people voted for it.
Right.
We're talking, maybe we got to do a grand bargain on the budget. Maybe we got to mess with Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Who's chairing the committee talking about? Paul Ryan, the guy we didn't elect.
Right.
And so if I'm a citizen and I said, man, I went out and hustled last year. I worked hard to make something happen. I got my result. I won big.
Right.
And I'm getting this.
Right.
That is dysfunctional. And at that point, we have to say to ourselves, Ms. Former State Representative, that it's no longer about just electing the best person,
mm-hmm.
no longer about the one party or the other. We have to start talking about structural changes that make sure that this isn't our reality from here on out.
Right. Right, that we're not leaving this for our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, dollarocracy.
Right.
That's exactly what it is. You know, and one way to look at it, people often pick on American voters, say, well, they're awful, they're dummies, they're lazy, they don't want to work, they don't vote. We have a lot of sympathy for American voters. When you look at what happens, just what John says, most of the races you go to vote for an American voter, the legislative races are gerrymandered. So it's like Bulgaria in 1960. You know who's going to win whether you vote or not. You have no influence. So most of your legislative races are that way. Then you get to the Senate and the presidency, statewide races, and you get to the presidency where money enters the fray and the Electoral College enters the fray. And even if you vote for a candidate because you want to protect Social Security, you want to protect public education, you want to protect and expand Medicare and Medicaid, even if your side wins, the money comes in and says, well, now we're going to have a discussion about doing exactly what you thought you voted against. It's meant to produce cynicism that we have 52% of our people voting in a presidential election. It says we have people hungry to be involved in politics, desperate to want to make government work, and everything's being done to hose them away from the polls.
Right, right. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. Hello, Nick. Welcome to KBOO. Mitch, sorry. Hello, Mitch. Welcome to KBOO.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out that when it comes to think tanks, it really isn't an issue of ideology. It's an issue of pursuing self-interest, because you've got people like Chaim Saban putting tons of money into think tanks that support the Democratic Party.
Without a doubt. Look, one of the things we say in our book, and this is a big deal, I think one of the most important just basic messages. In 2012, scrappy Barack Obama didn't beat big money.
Mm-hmm.
No. Barack Obama's big money beat Mitt Romney's big money. They both had huge amounts of big money.
That's right.
You know, we always say, well, Obama had a lot of small contributions. He did. But Obama also had a record level of big contributions.
That's right.
And the reality is that this money floods into both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a very dysfunctional politics, one in which both parties are deeply influenced by some of the same folks, some slightly different folks, but still with their own self-interest. And amazingly enough, there aren't a heck of a lot of poor folks funding think tanks and funding campaigns. So that's one side of it. But also, we have structural flaws in our democracy that make it virtually impossible to have multi-party elections that matter. Mm-hmm. This is a big deal. In countries around the world, most countries we would compare ourselves to, mm-hmm. they have 3, 4, 5
parties.
Options. Mm-hmm. Now, usually have 2 big parties, mm-hmm. but those alternative parties have huge influence on the process.
Yes.
Give you a very good example from France last year. France's credit rating was downgraded, and they also were having a lot of pressures economically. And there was a candidate on the left, Mélenchon, who was running for president. He didn't get elected president, but during his campaign, he banged away on the fact, we got to tax the speculators. We have to tax all this money moving around in the stock market, mm-hmm. stuff like that. Slowly, then the kind of major candidate of the left took that on, started saying, oh, we got to do that. Finally, by the end of the campaign, Sarkozy, the conservative president, was saying, we're going to have to start looking at a financial transaction tax. And you see, when you have a multi-party democracy, right. it's not just about electing that. You have a more fluid, open thing. In this country, when you have two parties that both rely so much structurally on their money coming right. from the big guys,
right.
we end up with a debate between, as our friend Jeff Cohen says, and Bill, Bob, you can...
The range of debate extends all the way from GE to GM.
And... Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Yeah, no, now that you have Bob and John on the show, I've asked this question before when there were less savvy political guests on.
Okay, butter them up.
I understand that it isn't about think tanks, because people of any ideology can put a think tank together and do what Chaim Saban did and basically hijack American policy, in his case, in favor of Israeli militantism. The question then is, what prevents unions or the wealthy liberal class in America from putting together a labor party as opposed to a Democratic party? Every other country has labor parties, and even if the labor parties are taken over, as happened with Blair's Great Purge, which is how Blair came to be Bush's best friend and brought the labor party with him, even if you have that, you still have to hold them to the rhetoric of being in favor of the labor class. We have no such nominal representation.
Okay, let's try to get an answer to your question. Thanks for the call.
You know, Mitch, that is a fantastic question. It's one that John and I have been wrestling with, because I think the major response to dollarocracy, to the billionaire corporate flooding of our political system and our governing system, is, well, let's get the liberal billionaires. Mm. Let's let them be representatives and let those two guys fight it out. And we could root for the liberal billionaires to win. But I mean, just for the way I say it rhetorically, it says how absurd that is ultimately.
Right.
The whole idea of democracy was, you know, as John likes to talk about when we do our book tours and events, you know, when the country began, it was a bunch of rich white guys in a room making the decisions. And everyone else was outside literally looking through the windows, because they had to keep the windows open so they wouldn't be too hot. And the whole point of democracy is to bring those people into the room so they were equal participants.
Right.
And now under dollarocracy, what's happening is the room's being vacated except for billionaires. And now we still stand outside and we get to look inside and say, I hope my liberal billionaire advances something I like.
That's right.
Because they get to control what issues we talk about. They right. get, and this is, even to make it worse, what candidates get to run, what gets done in office. We talked to a very well-known political organizer who supports liberal Democratic campaigns, the sort of person who would be in a Labor Party if we had one in this country. He no longer will even handle candidates, run campaigns for candidates who aren't already multimillionaires.
That's right.
You've got to have money even to get in the game right. to oppose money.
Right.
And the absurdity of this has got to be clear. He said you can have these billionaires advance the issues of the poor. Well, no, the reason they have labor parties in Britain, the reason you have labor parties in Norway or Japan or anywhere, wasn't because some billionaire in Japan said, I want a labor party for my peons. It was because the peons said, we need a party representing our interests, and they did the organizing. Right. That's democracy. We're in this point now where we're reduced to rooting for our favorite billionaires. So it's like the 100 relevant citizens in America, and the rest right. of us are in the sidelines.
And I have one more little thing to add. Billionaires are different than us.
Yes.
Yeah, just a little. And the interesting thing about there, I've met billionaires. Mm-hmm. Not a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, you pick them up when they're hitchhiking, and you get to talk to them a little. And the interesting thing about billionaires is this. They are a product of their experience. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about poverty to them, they may well say poverty, very good. I'm putting that on my list of, you know, mm-hmm. issues on my mm-hmm. agenda of things I want to worry about. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about global warming too and stuff. Well, the trouble with that is that then the core concerns of the great mass of Americans, country with growing inequality, country where we literally have tens of millions of people who are getting by in abject poverty, tens of millions more who only make it because of food stamps, which we're now debating getting rid of.
Right.
You know, when you're in a situation like that, the core concerns of the great mass of people become kind of agenda items. Mm-hmm. And even if you have the best wealthy person, even if you have the most noble person who really is concerned people, and they exist,
right.
The fact is that's not how it's supposed to work.
Right.
In a democracy, the agenda should be set from the base up, from the great mass of people up. And you know, hardly the most left-wing person in history, Hubert Humphrey,
right.
said, he had this wonderful line, it's still the greatest. He said, you know, the way you measure a country is not by how the wealthy are doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's how the poorest of the poor are doing. You know, that's a good country. And he borrowed that line from Tom Paine, one of the founding figures in our American experiment. And all I would tell you is that this, we find this to be a real big danger in our current moment. Mm-hmm. We have people who are saying, well, you know, maybe billionaires and very wealthy people will save our media by creating new media projects. And they, some of them might do some good things. Maybe billionaires will, you know, help us to turn to a greater concern about inequality. Maybe billionaires will help put, in fact, there's just a billionaire who put a lot of money into the Virginia governor's race
right.
on climate change. And we're all, and that can be very enticing, right?
Right, right.
Because then you think somebody's going to ride in to save you.
Yes.
I got news for you. Eugene Victor Debs was right. Great socialist leader of the first part of the century. He said to his millions of followers and supporters, if I could lead you into paradise, mm-hmm. I wouldn't do it. Because if I could lead you in, somebody else could lead you out.
Excellent. We got callers backed up, so we're going to try to get as many in as possible before we get to solutions. BJ, welcome to KBOO. BJ?
Well, one of the problems is money is so big pay. They didn't have billionaires when I was in college, which wasn't that long ago. In the 60s, I was in Samuel College. It was $265 million was the Rockefellers, and the book was The Rich and the Super Rich by, I think, Erickson.
Uh-huh.
You remember the following. But now they get paid $200,000 a year. In those days, it was $20,000. There's too much money in the game, and that's not counting the perks.
Right.
Lobbyists get a brand-new fancy Lincoln or Cadillac. I don't understand why they get so much money in politics unless they get rewarded. So they get tremendous reward. I happen to be a friend of some of them, one of Wyden, but I mean, he's not here anymore. He moved to
New Jersey.
Yeah, well, he had to because.
But yet we elected him
for the meetings. Have you met his twins?
No, I haven't met his twins, but you know, I'm glad his wife and family are doing well in Jersey, even though he's our Oregon senator.
Well, anyway, those guys. Look, I'm not making any money. I've just had property tax. I'm on Social Security because of my age. I'm 75 and holding.
All right.
And I like to say something about the tax structure for property should be overhauled here. I'm paying now $2,200 in the urban renewal abatement area in North Portland in 927-201. I'm sorry to be so convoluted about it, but I just got off the phone with the Salem, and I'm paying for the call to Salem. And, well, actually, he reversed it. And then he says, well, get back down to 501 Hawthorne and find out why. Get something in. You got to be here 5 years. Well, I've been there 5 years in the other house, barely, and I didn't know. They changed the laws, the rules.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
And I don't understand that.
So let me cut to the chase, give you an opportunity to get your problem solved. Who is your state representative?
What's his name?
Okay, yeah. So you need to contact Oh, What's His Name.
Okay.
And have Oh, What's His Name actually intervene on your behalf so that he can help explain to you the changes in the law so that you can get your property tax taken care of. Okay?
Okay, good.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Hello, Dave. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, lady and gentlemen. Two words, Supreme Court. We have a far-right corporatist court that has hijacked part of the function of Congress. How do we get a court that won't continue to legislate in favor of wealth?
I think we got some answers.
Like
thank
that.
You.
Thanks for I'll take my
answer off the air.
Thank
compliments
you.
Compliments for forming it in the, putting it in the form of a question. look, this guy nailed it, right? He got right to the heart of the matter.
Right.
Only he was too polite. He said it's a corporatist Supreme Court. We have an activist Supreme Court.
We have
a Supreme Court that's highly engaged in shaping the direction of the country.
Yes.
In fact, here's the interesting thing. They say nothing ever gets done in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the legislative or executive branch, but a hell of a lot gets done over in the judicial branch. They are literally shaping the direction of this country with their rulings. And they have made one thing absolutely clear. When campaign finance issues arise, they are going to side on anything that really matters.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to side with very wealthy people and corporations say they can do whatever they want.
Right.
They've made one other thing absolutely clear. When voters are having a hard time voting, they're going to make it harder.
Right.
So that's a pretty interesting equation.
Yes.
And our caller says, well, how are we going to get a better Supreme Court? You know, with all due respect, that's not our issue. Mm-hmm. You get to serve on the Supreme Court as long as you live. They have really good doctors. And so the fact of the matter is, they could be there for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
Ginsburg, right? She's like around 80.
Right.
She just did a press conference. She said, yeah, I think I'll stay with them for quite a bit longer.
Yeah.
And so the theory that these people are going to go and we wait till they get it done, that's our mistake.
Mm-hmm.
What we have to recognize is that Thomas Jefferson, imperfect founder, had a really good line. He said, you know, money's going to corrupt this thing.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, it's going to start to corrupt the legislators. It's going to start to corrupt the executive, even the judges. So at a certain point, it's important that we rested all power in the people.
Mm-hmm.
And what they meant by resting all power in the people is they gave us the ability to overrule the court.
Yes.
To overrule the Congress.
Yes.
To overrule the president. Not just at elections, but structurally. We have the ability to amend our Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that scares some people.
Mm-hmm.
They think, oh, amend the Constitution, that's impossible. You know, the Constitution was handed down on stone tablets to Michelle Bachmann.
Right?
She carries it with her. But you know what the funny thing about it is?
What?
The founders amended the Constitution 10 times in the first 4 years.
Yeah.
Then they amended it again 15 years later when the vice president shot the Secretary of Treasury because they thought we should have a better way to elect vice presidents.
Right.
We've amended the Constitution 27 times throughout our history, almost always,
mm-hmm.
almost always, to extend democracy, to give women the vote, to get rid of the poll tax,
mm-hmm.
to open this thing up. And so what we are saying, and it's the last chapters of this book, what we argue is that we have got to amend the Constitution to overrule the court
mm-hmm.
and to say, no, money is not speech. Corporations are not people. We have a right to organize a politics in our country where the vote matters more than the dollar. We have a right to protect the vote
mm-hmm.
and guarantee that. And I know this can sound to some folks like, wow, that's pretty big talk there. But here's the thing. 16 states have already formally demanded that Congress start to move on the amending of the Constitution to get money out of politics. And the most recent state to do so was the state of Oregon, right around July 4th of this year. And so the fact is, something real is happening out there.
Mm-hmm.
If we had a media that covered politics in this country, everybody'd know about it, and we'd already have won,
right,
frankly,
right.
if we covered grassroots movements.
Right.
Our job, what we're out here doing, more than anything else, is saying to people, we can change this thing. It will not be easy. We know that.
Right.
But it is necessary. And what we started to see around the country that just chills us and gives us great joy is that Republicans in states around this country have started to join Democrats. In Maine, 30 Republicans voted with the Democrats to tell Congress to overturn Citizens United and get money out of politics. Something's happening out there, Joanne.
Wonderful.
And we're here in KBOO talking about it today. We need to spread that word all over the country.
Well, I think people are hearing you loud and clear because the phones are all lit up. We're going to go back to the phone line. Roberta, welcome to KBOO.
Hi. Well, you started to answer my question, which is, what's the fix? And if you only have one chapter in your book, I got to tell you, a whole bunch of us have been talking about all the other chapters for many years. And we need to have a coordinated campaign of some kind to get those of us that want to fix it together. I think a whole bunch of people want to do something, but we don't mm-hmm. know where to start and how to begin and who's working on it, because as you said, it isn't being reported.
Right.
So how do we do that?
Thank you, Roberta, for the question, and they're going to answer it.
Roberta, we have great news for you. There are so many people working on this issue. John and I, in this book tour for the last 2 months, have probably done around 50 talks all over the country. Mm-hmm. At every event, including the event last night at Paul's, And at the event, I bet it today at Portland State, and then tonight at the University of Oregon and at the law school. At every single event we've done, with like one exception, and even small college events, there are volunteers from the community on their own. We don't arrange it. Who comes are organizing on these issues, collecting.
They have a table set up.
Yeah,
and a petition.
Taking petitions, getting people organized, getting them to come in and work with them, and they're collecting names. And there's this grassroots movement going on constitutional amendments and a variety of other reforms too, and other types of activism. But I think primarily constitutional amendments that is simply astonishing. And like John said, if we had a news media that covered this, Roberta wouldn't feel like, gosh, nothing. What can I do? There's nothing.
How do we pull it together?
She'd be in the middle of the front lines,
right.
And so it's going on, and it's not being supported by billionaires. It's not George Soros wrote them a check. This is purely grassroots, and it's extraordinary how effective it's been. So I would say to Roberta, the good news is there are people right now really working hard. There are people in this community, lots of them, who are working on it. So I'd say get out there. Get involved. This is an issue. This is one of the truly great issues where the further you get away from people with power, away from government, across the political spectrum, no one likes the idea that money rules. Even conservatives, who grassroots conservatives, think their ideas are better. They want to win a battle of ideas. They don't want to buy an election. And that's at the dollarcrats at top who want to buy the government.
Right.
And so this is an issue that really is it's a gold mine. And it's winning. We're taking place now. John can mention a couple of the groups.
Well, last night at Paul's. Another thing we'll tell you, too, is it's really encouraging to us. We go to these events. They're packed.
Yes.
And so that's an amazing thing. It's not because of us. We think it's because of these fundamental issues.
Oh,
no.
You don't think they came to see you? I'm sure they came to see you.
Yeah, my mom does. But,
we're such good-looking guys.
Handsome fellas coming through. But look, the reality is very, very simple. These people are deeply concerned. They're looking for a way out. And we are blown away by how well-organized folks already are.
Mm-hmm.
But they do. That's why we're here. That's why we're spreading the word.
Right.
So we had a woman pop her hand up last night, the last person to ask a question. Didn't ask a question. Those are the people we like.
Right.
She said, I don't want to go on and on. I just want to tell you, we meet every, I'm not going to say which night of the week, at the Unitarian Meeting House here in town. We're talking about taking it to the next step. She's associated with a group called Move to Amend.
Mm-hmm.
Move to Amend. You can find them on the web. There's another group called Free Speech for People.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many other groups. Common Cause has gotten real engaged with these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so check them out, Roberta. You're going to find somebody who is starting to pull it together.
Mm-hmm.
And we also want to emphasize, you have members of Congress from this city and from this area who are supposedly liberal, you know, progressive.
Supposedly.
Well, you know, I know sometimes they do great. Sometimes, you know. But here's the deal. No matter what they're at, even if they say to you, they say, well, I signed on to the proposal for amendment. You say, well, what did you do this week?
Right.
We need to put that. We got to turn that heat up on them so that they don't just say, well, Oregon voted and encouraged Congress to do it, and I'll take a note of that. No, no.
Right.
We say, we asked you to do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We want you to be a co-sponsor. We want you to be, you know, pushing for this to be in hearings, to talk about this. Let's get this thing moving.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is that when America decided that we were finally going to let women have the right to vote, that period from when Congress gave the go to when women were voting, that was under 2 years.
Right.
It moved very, very fast. There's a lot of history when we decided to finally get rid of the poll tax. Very brief period, within a matter of a year or so, where, you know, it actually started to just sweep across the country. We need to understand that at critical junctures, that can happen. But for it to happen, we have to have members of Congress that all they're hearing about, you know, it just keeps banging into their ear. We can make it happen, but Roberta and everybody else has to be a part of it.
Absolutely a great point. We've got a couple of more callers on the line. We're going to try to squeak them in if we can. I'm sorry, who was that? Esteban. Welcome to KBOO.
Yes, good morning, folks. Thanks for being there.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could discuss the possibility or the feasibility of American citizens, say the 99%, contributing at maybe a nominal dollar each and incorporating. The American citizens becoming a corporation, thereby guaranteeing our free speech and also forming a small d democracy.
I'll give you a variation on this, Esteban. I saw a poster at a rally. Says, I believe corporations are people when Texas executes one. But, you know, it gets pretty dark humor sometimes. But the flip, of course, is your proposal that people incorporate. Do you know what the terrible thing about that, Esteban, is? What the unsettling thing is? You said if we all incorporate and everybody give a dollar?
Right.
That mean we'd all the voting people of voting age, that'd get us to around $200 million.
Right.
One guy, Sheldon Adelson last year, gave more than $200 million. So if we incorporated and all of us gave a dollar, there'd be one guy in Las Vegas outspending us.
And, you know, we do the math in the book.
It's not a matter of money. It's the idea that we would have the ability then to become a small D democracy, because all the stakeholders then would, by their Social Security number, have a voter ID, and we could decide democratically two-thirds majority of 200 million
people. But not if you don't take all the billions out. Esteban, not if you don't take all the billions out. All you're going to do is, all you're doing is adding another 220 million as compared to doing away with billionaires controlling the process.
No, that just gives us an infrastructure. That pays for our infrastructure for us to decide and vote ourselves, eliminating the government. Step outside and create our own.
Okay, Esteban, we're going to leave it on that mark because we're just about out of time. Thank you so much for your call.
It takes time.
Yes, it does. Have a great day. Thank you. Did you want to comment on anything?
No, do we have another caller? Let's get to it.
We do have another caller. We're going to try to squeak in. Zapata, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, how you doing? I'm an avid listener and a frequent caller.
I love the fact that I am not familiar with your voice, so welcome.
Awesome. I'm a younger person, and I vote. I've been voting since I turned 18 for the past two elections. And there's a lot of I've been hearing lately from a lot of other younger people, you know, my peer group, saying that it's just, you know, politics aren't worth it, voting's not worth it.
Right.
Because history just repeats itself. You know?
Right.
And I really started thinking about it, like, if history repeated itself, would it still be considered history, or would it be part of the system that we
need to... It's the movie Groundhog's Day.
yeah, kind of, sort of, right? Where I feel like we're, as a country, we're revisiting issues that we've got over in the last 50 years.
Oh, you are so right. You know, we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. What were the big issues 50 years ago in the March on Washington? They were health care. They were jobs. They were police brutality. They were economic opportunity. They
and
were education.
Voting rights.
They were voting rights. Yeah, and what are the big issues today? the exact same issues.
Yeah, and I wasn't alive 50 years ago. So that's good to hear that.
I'm afraid I was.
So was I.
I'm not sure it's good to hear that we're doing with them again, though. That's the problem. We should solve problems and move on to the next thing.
So remember, we're awesome. That's all I had to say, and thank you guys. Keep it up.
Thank you for your call. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. It looks like we've got about a minute and 30 seconds left.
Well, I just would start, but we made this point earlier in the show, but I don't know if Zapata heard it. You know, when people feel cynical and depressed and want to give up, say it's hopeless, that's exactly what people in power want you to feel. That's not a rebellious feeling. It's a very rational response to the cues you're being given to give up, abandon hope, don't do anything. Because if you don't do anything, if you act like social change for the better is impossible, you're doing your part to make sure it is impossible.
That's right.
The only thing any individual controls is what they do when they look in the mirror to address the situation. And what we all know and what people in power know is if people get off their dust and say, I'm not going to take this anymore, I'm going to organize to make this a genuinely democratic society, we will win. And the reason why there's so much pressure now to have unlimited corporate spending and billionaire spending on one hand, and so much pressure to suppress the vote on the other hand, is that the people in power, the corporations, the dominant financial interests, know they can't win a fair election. This is a progressive country. If we had anything remotely close to high turnout elections in this country as you do in other democracies, this would be a vastly different country.
And final word, John?
Basically what he said.
What he said.
but I will say, just finally, this has been a wonderful conversation here. Your listeners have been great.
Yeah.
And all I'll tell you is it's great to have these conversations.
Yes.
They will serve this cause best if they come off this conversation, go on the internet, make a call, get engaged, put on your website some groups that they can join with.
Yes,
because
I will.
We are on the cusp of changing this thing. And if you're just a listener to this show, engage today,
right,
we can do it.
Yes, we can. And in fact, I was so glad you mentioned Move to Amend. David Delks locally has done a phenomenal job of organizing folks around this change that is absolutely necessary. I am Joanne Hardesty. As you can hear by the music, we are done today. I am so thrilled to have our guests, Dollarocracy, John Nichols, Robert W. McChesney. They will be around today. You can find the info on my website. Joanne Hardesty, see you next week, same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that bitter is gold. After story had never been told.
Don't give up the fight. Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high.
And good morning. This is KBOO Portland, 9 o'clock straight up on this Thursday morning. Coming up in a half hour on A Deeper Look, host Linda Olson Osterlin interviews Arthur Stamoulis of the Citizen Trade Campaign about how trade agreements put workers and the environment at risk. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off. We'll go straight to Flashpoints today, featuring a look at the homeless fighting eviction in Albany, California, and an interview with Nora Barrows Friedman about torture victims in Israeli-occupied Palestine. At 11 today on Between the Covers, the guest is local author Rainer Ward, who discusses his new novel, Advent, the story of a young man instrumental in expanding the psychedelic drug revolution. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, comics journalist extraordinaire and occasional Portlander Joe Sacco speaks with host S.W. Concer about his new project, The Great War, a 24-foot-long panorama depicting the first day of the Battle of the Somme. That's all coming up, but first on Press Watch, host Teresa Mitchell asked, why identify with your oppressors? And do you have the strength to open your heart to your fellow planetary citizen? That is coming up next on Press Watch.
KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present The Yes Men Fix the World. Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO will be showing the 2009 indie classic film, The Yes Men Fix the World. The Yes Men Fix the World is the true story of two political activists posing as executives of giant corporations. In their thrift store suits, they lie their way into big business conferences and pull off pranks. That's The Yes Men Fix the World, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/yesmen2013.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance? Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music.